Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our program this morning. I hope you had a nice weekend, and just hope you are enjoying getting ready for the big holiday coming up on Thursday. And many of you have Thursday and Friday off. We have Thursday and Friday off, so we'll try to jam 3 days worth of horrible news into 3 days. And we welcome you this morning. And thank you so much for being with us. If you would like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. We had a neat event, a big event in Greenwich, New York, this weekend, which is the Lighted Tractor Parade. This is a big deal in our town.
Wow.
Tens of thousands of people come from all over to see the lighted tractors and on Saturday night. And it was a chilly night, but it was beautiful. And but not like too chilly. You know, it was still like you could deal with it. And the tractors went off. The kids were a part of it. And it was a major cool parade, and it was so neat to see that many people in the village ready for the holidays and having fun and catching up with people. So that was great fun and something that I enjoyed immensely. So yesterday I went to our friend Connie Brooks and to the store Battenkill Books. And they had a book reading by an author by the name of Julia Spencer Fleming. And Julia Spencer Fleming is a New York Times bestselling mystery writer. She is fantastic, absolutely incredible, and writes about, she lives in Maine, but she writes about Washington County and Argyle. And so she has this new book out called At Midnight Comes the Cry. And I was very excited. So I got the new book yesterday. I listened to her. I got it signed. And I went home and I started to read it. First chapter is about the Greenwich Lighted Tractor Parade.
No way.
It was so cool.
That's
it's
great.
So cool. And the book ends like just after Christmas. So I'm just going to like pace it, you know, like
read
in real time.
Right.
Yeah, read it in real time.
Can you manage to do that? Can you control yourself?
No, it'll be done tomorrow.
I didn't think so.
No,
yeah.
It'll be done tomorrow. Yeah. Julia Spencer Fleming, again, the name of the book is At Midnight Comes Comes the Cry. It's been 5 years since her last novel, we've been missing her, but she's back, and it's thrilling, and the Russ Van Alstyne Claire Ferguson series, and it's great. So that was my weekend. I also want to mention, too, that... Oh, there was something else I wanted to mention, Libby. What was it? I don't know. We're not going to be here Thursday and Friday.
Right.
I have the thing. Yeah. I'll think of it.
Okay.
It's not a big deal. Let me introduce everybody here, and then we'll get started, which is what we want to do. Laurel Elder is with us. We are so excited. Laurel has been a little while since Laurel's been here, and we're thrilled that she's here. Professor of Political Science at Hartwick College in Oneonta, co-director of the Institute of Public Service. Good morning, Laurel Elder. How are you?
I am doing really well. Very excited to be back with you, Joe, and with your amazing panelists and with your audience. Yeah, I think it's been since summer since I've been here. It's been a busy fall semester because I teach about American politics and elections and run an institute, as you mentioned, focused on getting young people engaged in our democracy, especially at the local level. So we've been busy doing all that this fall. We registered so many Hartwick College students to vote in Oneonta. We had a polling place for the first time ever on campus. We had, forums for our local candidates. We had students interview the mayoral candidates in our town. That was great. And I think my favorite event we did, because we're not just trying to get Hartwick students involved in democracy. We want to get young people in our region engaged and realizing it can actually be fun to be part of democracy, which is, you know, sometimes we forget that these days with all the negative headlines. And so we had an I Voted sticker design competition for all ages.
Oh, great.
Yes. And I have to say the winning design by the elementary school kid was a cat holding a flag. As one of my colleagues said, you got to love a patriotic cat. And off to the corner is a mouse with a ballot in his hand voting for dog.
Oh, no, oh, see, that is great.
That's I mean,
great.
And
that's
so
full circle. That's
we took these winning designs and we made them into actually stickers and we gave them out at Hartwick on election day. So, like, the kids got to see their designs actually be part of the process. Anyway, every time I look at the cat, the patriotic cat and the mouse voting for dog, it makes me incredibly happy.
Yes, that is very cool. What a great mindset in the kid to come up with that. That's really terrific. We welcome the preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. Terry Gibson is with us. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing really well. You know, I've been thinking for a while that my cat has political potential. And, you know, I finally think there's an opening here that I can help him, you know, build a campaign for public office. This is great. I love this.
Yes.
Yes.
It just needs a flag.
Because cats are so open and personable.
Just talk to me, Terry. We can make something happen.
There you go. The deal is done. Libby Post is the voice you just heard, political consultant, lobbyist, long time, has been with the show since its inception, the panel anyway. Good morning. Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm good. I'm better than I was last week.
Yeah, I know you were had a little touch of the food poisoning. That's good.
Right, which I would not.
Do you know the culprit?
I think it was arugula. And, you know, it's like the FDA is not overseeing food like they used to. There's been problems with leaf-like food, and I think I got it, and it was
you know,
fun.
I didn't need a reason, but that's a good enough reason for me to never eat arugula again.
I love arugula. That's the problem. I really like it. And no offense to any restaurant who might have it on their menu, but it was, I've never experienced anything like it, and I hope never to do it again.
Well, we're glad you're back.
Thank
we're glad
you.
You're feeling better,
yes.
And that is wonderful. Finally, we welcome Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel is here. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing great. I just mentally took the arugula salad, which was, in fact, on my menu off my menu for Thanksgiving.
Sorry.
I love arugula, too. But it's we actually had the World Affairs Council an extraordinarily busy week last week. It started out with a discussion on climate change and attracted so many people to listen. That was so reassuring to me because I, for a while, thought the discussion on climate change was dead. And it evidently is not. And I learned about these new nuclear reactors, which I'm going to learn more about, which look very different to the old ones. So I'm on the fence about this idea of going back to nuclear, but it's I'll be open-minded. I'll learn more about it. And then we had a fantastic, in Woodstock, a fantastic discussion on morals and ethics in international relations. Our own Jim Ketterer was there,
yes,
was fabulous as always, mm-hmm, but we also had a representative of the Carnegie Council, and it was so eye-opening, in particular about going back to your efforts to engage the young, particularly about the need to really build up knowledge about the significance of soft power, our presence in the world, our contributions to the world for our own interests from the bottom up. And so as a final point, at the World Affairs Council always hosts a student World Affairs Conference every year, and we just had it on Friday. So this was a busy week, but it's there is nothing more rewarding than to actually see young people one at a time become involved, engaged, and just enthusiastic about being part of what's so important for us to do.
I feel Libby talking about working with dogs and kittens, and Terry's there at Harvard molding the young minds. You're working on election issues and getting kids to vote, and you're working on climate change and international relations. I went to go see some tractors.
Hey, everyone has their role to play, Joe.
Yeah, I know. I guess so. I did remember the other thing I wanted to tell you about because I didn't get to it in the billboard, but we have two things coming up in our 11 o'clock hour. One is a great writer by the name of Benjamin Wood has a new novel out. It's called Sea Scraper. It was longlisted for the Booker Prize, and it is terrific, and we will talk to Benjamin Wood this morning. Also, we are a part of WAMC on the Road helps and does these events with the Culinary Arts at SPAC, and we do them throughout the year. And I just did one a little bit ago on barbecue. Sarah did one just last week, I think, on Nigerian cuisine, West African culture, and Azaz Soko was the author, is the author, and has a book out called Chop Chop, Cooking with Foods of Nigeria, and Azaz Soko will be speaking with Sarah later on. So that's coming up, so I wanted to make mention of that. Okay, on with the show, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome you as always. I'm going to sort of go backwards because of how the weekend folded out, but Marjorie Taylor Greene, okay, that was a shocker when that happened on Friday night. Didn't expect that.
Nope.
We had many of us who are our news hounds were watching President Trump and the mayor-elect of New York City, Zoran Mamdani, together and seem to have what the news with the cable channels way too often referred to as a bro fest.
I was thinking of it as a bromance, but that's okay.
Okay, whatever.
Right.
It was the two of them seemed to get along. It was very warm. It was I think in our national politics now, when two people actually are cordial, it's a major thing.
Yes.
So yeah. It was incredible.
And so true.
And then you have this person who he called a socialist and Mamdani called Trump a fascist and they're getting along. And then the person who was at the, you know, wore all the red hats and came to the mm-hmm. State of the Union addresses and got
and
up and screamed and yelled
Biden,
and
right.
Well, now she said, I'm done. I'm out. I will be out as of January 5th. And it was a shock resignation. It surprised just about everyone. And and if you watch the video announcement, which was posted Friday night, 11 minutes long, and it went viral. And it was really just a laundry list of policy and political disagreements with Trump, with the Republican Party, with Speaker Mike Johnson, and she positioned herself as the true MAGA champion and declared that if she had been cast aside, then many common Americans have been cast aside and replaced as well. Laurel, I didn't see this one coming.
I didn't either. I know this is an incredible story for so many reasons. I feel like I could talk about it for an hour and a half, but I'm not going to do that. I'll just lay out a couple reasons why I think it's really, you know, fascinating, and then maybe we can circle back to some of the others. But I mean, first of all, here is, you know, there's 435 members of Congress. Most people can't name any of them, and even their own representative in many cases. But most people know Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's been on the national scene for a short time, but she is super well known. I mean, she's OG MAGA. Like, she's been there from the beginning, and all of a sudden, here she is. It's been building for a while, but she's taking the script. I mean, we know the drill, as you said, that, you know, it's like make America great again supporters. They support Trump, whatever he does. They find a way to justify whatever he says. And she took that whole script and she threw it out the window. She challenged Trump not just on the Epstein files, but on the government shutdown, on healthcare subsidies, on U.S. approach to Israel. And so it's just like it's jaw dropping. And now she's talking about we should be more civil in politics. And she's sorry for the role she played in our toxic politics. So it's just the, you know, it reminds us that I guess people can evolve, and it's just, it's really, it's kind of jaw-dropping. It's also, I'm sure we'll talk about this more, really a window into some of the tensions within the Republican Party, and it opens this question of, like, what is the Republican Party and what is the MAGA movement beyond Trump? Once he's no longer on the political stage or no longer commanding all the power, where does the future of the Republican Party lie? And then, of course, I'm someone who studies gender and politics. So this gets a lot less attention in the news media. But I think this whole situation really underscores the Republican Party's really significant problem with women. And by that, I mean there are very few women Republicans in Congress. Less than 15% of the Republicans in Congress are women. That number hasn't increased in over three decades. And what that means on a practical level is that on a lot of committees and when a lot of important decisions are being made and priorities, there is maybe one or maybe no women part of the Republican Party discussions on these issues. And, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene's experience, I think, and deciding to drop out mid-session is not going to help that problem.
We've seen several graphics in the New York Times, and I point to them just because I've noticed that. And I know other sources have done it, but there'll be a chart of the people who have left the administration, let's say, the generals and the military leaders who have been cast aside, women, mm-hmm. blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go to who has been cast aside in various departments, in the FBI, in the Treasury Department, and you can go down the list, and it's women and women of color. Mm-hmm. I would say,
and then you look at the professions that have just been deprofessionalized. Like nursing, right?
Yes.
It's no longer considered a profession, which is
or
such...
Or architects, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's just such bull. I mean, it really, really is. It goes to Trump's I love the uneducated ethos. But, you know, when you do nursing, is dominated by women, a lot of women of color, and you'll see those folks running for office. Maybe not for Congress, but for other things. But I do want to do a footnote here. In terms of the MAGA women who do run... Moms for Liberty, is that what they're mm-hmm. called, right? They ran a bunch of people for school boards across the country, and they all lost. Because the book banning and going after trans kids and all that sort of stuff just isn't selling when people can't afford the basics of feeding their children, of being able to go to the doctor.
Yeah, I mean, that said, I mean, there are literally millions of highly qualified conservative women out there who could be running. If I was I'm not a Republican consultant, but if I were, I would be trying to recruit these women and getting them to run. I mean, over 40% of women voted for Trump. And I just think, one, for optics sake, I mean, how long can the Republican Party be out there as a party that's 85% white male in our growing, you know, diverse society? But I also think it has real implications for the agenda of the party and the policies they craft. And I think the Epstein situation sort of illustrates this. So, of course, only four Republicans joined with all the Democrats to vote to, you know, on the discharge petition to have a full vote on making the Epstein files public. And three of those four Republican were women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the point is that women and men still, they walk through the world. They have different experiences in the aggregate. And they bring those different experiences to the table. I mean, one of them spoke about her own experience as a teenager being sexually assaulted and why that motivated her, Nancy Mace. And so, you know, it's just having women in the Republican Party, I think, makes it a better party. And I think it's a problem how women have been, you know, treated in the Republican Party overall.
I agreed. It's like I agreed that for me, when I see the very low numbers of women in Congress, first and foremost, it raises red flags. What stands in the way of women mm-hmm. running, of being women being elected? I think that's a problem that across the board. It's also true for the Democratic Party. I think the last time I checked, about 22% of members of Congress, both the Senate and the House, were women, and it has actually gone up a little bit, and I think that's mostly because of the Democratic Party, but it's low. Right? But to me, mostly the numbers, when they're this low, it raises red flags. What keeps them from running? What keeps mm-hmm. them from winning elections? Now, in terms of the policy impact, it's certainly any kind of diversity changes the dynamics, without a doubt. But I'm actually going to shy away from looking at Marjorie Taylor Greene as a necessary component in our national political discussion. I mean, she stepped down because she would have faced an upward battle in a very red district against a candidate who would have been endorsed by Trump. I'm not sure whether she was targeted because she's a woman, right? It's like, to me, the discussion here is more interesting in that is, as you said, it illustrates the You know, our political party system is truly unique compared to other democracies, because our political parties are not parties per se. They're not institutions, top-down institutions, as there are in other countries. They are movements. And so both Democratic Party and Republican Party see this fluctuation of debates within the political parties rather than outside. And so we're seeing right now where the Republican Party is going. And what I'm seeing is that we're not moving away from the MAGA approach. We're defining what MAGA means. And there isn't that much, I don't see much, where I see the crux of the debate is, are we going to be more hawkish in foreign affairs? But we're not going to move away from our immigration policies and a reduction in social services and focus on decreasing taxes. So I don't really see an opening. I'm not optimistic that this opens up a possibilities for a more inclusive political party, Republican Party. The question is, what is MAGA going to look like in the future? And that's the extent to it.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I'm just really torn on sort of which way to go on this. I see it sort of two different ways, and I feel like we're sort of missing some information. I've been around politics too long to not be somewhat skeptical of what I'm hearing. I watched the entire video, and I wonder if they have something on her that she is afraid might be revealed if she has to go through this bloody primary, and maybe it's just easier to get out. At the same time, I can certainly understand why a person would not want to subject themselves to the pain that's certainly coming. But at the same time, Trump has not done that well in his effort to primary people in the past, and his popularity is really low right now, and chances are it may not be any higher by the time we get to primary season. So I'm not so sure I buy this idea that she would not be able to withstand a primary challenge. I mean, you're talking about someone who has, I think, next to Trump, probably one of the largest microphones in the country on the conservative side of politics. And to just simply walk away from that after having invested, as she openly admitted, so much personal capital to gain that kind of power and that kind of voice, me seems just kind of odd and slightly suspicious. Maybe she has plans to run for higher office. That's possible. That would make sense. Maybe she has plans to work in the media capacity somehow, start her own media channel, have a podcast. I mean, we do know that Trump is actually more influenced by people in the media than he is people that are actually serving as elected officials. So there is an avenue for her to continue to be an advocate for the conservative causes that she champions. I can't help but see it as a loss for the Republican Party. I mean, they're losing one of their strongest voices that was actually in the House as an elected official that will now be outside as probably more of a troublemaker than anything else. So not that they ever could control anything she was doing, but they certainly won't have the opportunity to do it now. And I see it as somewhat of a win for the Democrats to have that single voice taken out of an elected position where they can't vote against things that Democrats are trying to get passed. But overall, I think there's a really good chance that she'll just be forgotten in time, and it'll just kind of go down in history as another voice that was there that is just kind of fades away. I just don't really quite know what to think of this and where it's going to all end up, but it is interesting to contemplate.
Well, she did say she's not running for president, which is a really, really good thing. Look, the Republican Party has a problem with women, period. If they could get rid of all the women that are in Congress right now and replace them with white men, they'd be much happier, as we all know. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think, woke up a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit, to see what the shutdown meant for her constituents. The shutdown impacts red states more than it impacts blue states, because more people in the red states are on federal benefits like, you know, food stamps and all of that, than there are in the blue states, despite the rhetoric of the Republican Party and the targeting of the welfare mom as always a woman of color. So, you know, I think she may end up running for governor or running for the state house or something like that, where she's not going to be a target like she has been for Trump now. It's amazing to me how easy it is for Trump to just throw people to the side and, you know, you disagree with me. I mean, that's the issue. You disagree with me, you're done. There's nothing to, there's no reason to talk, no conversation, no nothing. You disagree with me, you're done, and that's the end of it. And so, you know, I think we'll hear from her again. Whether she'll have the kind of power, you know, who knows? Whether they have anything over her, I mean, other than, you know, stealing money, right, from the federal government. Everybody knows about her personal life, and it, you know, it's not
great. I was going to say, I don't know what you could come up with that would be damaging at this point to her.
Right, and she was able to get reelected anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, Lauren Boebert as well, and her personal whatevers. So, I don't think we should say that, oh, we're missing a woman's voice now. Because she was not a voice for women. Let's be honest. She was anti-choice. She was incredibly transphobic as well as homophobic. She was anti-Semitic. You know, I have a little button about the Jewish space lasers, right? You know, all of that. And so she was not a voice for women. She was a woman who had a voice. But that's two distinctly different things. And the Republican Party does not care about women. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. They're okay with women bleeding out in the parking lots. And that's what's happening. And they're okay with kids dying of measles in this country. And that's what's happening. And they're okay with people getting cancer, like Tatiana Schlossberg, because they have cut the funding, right? And they're okay with that, too.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We welcome you, and we'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We go to letters. We're talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene and her resignation from Congress that is effective January 5th. And we learned about this on Friday evening. It was, I think, for most, a surprise. Ed says, Marjorie isn't going anywhere. She, Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson will soon unite behind J.D. Vance and form an extreme America First isolationist white nationalist MAGA for 2028. The new guard is in town.
Yeah, maybe. Right.
Yeah, all right.
Some of them are the old guard, guarding some new stuff.
You know, Terry, you mentioned this about whether it be media, but I sort of have her pegged. If I had to guess, I don't know, I have no idea, but if I had to peg what's going to happen, I think of her sort of as a Joe Scarborough type, who goes onto a cable network and has
an epiphany.
No, not an epiphany. No, well, that came later. I mean, that epiphany came way later than that for him.
Yeah.
But you go on and you share Jen Psaki the same way. I mean, there are several people who follow this, and I think she has, unlike a lot of other people who have left the party, who. You know, like, say, like an Adam Kissinger, would they be able to dominate and have a show where they become the star? I don't think so.
And I think the other point about it is because she's, I mean, there's a lot of, as there is every election cycle, people have announced they're retiring or they're not going to seek re-election. But a lot of these people are Republicans or people who've had, you know, conflicts with Trump, like, you know, Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, or Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina. But she is a Make America Great Again. And I think people want to know, what does MAGA think? You know, and Tom Tillis or Joni Ernst aren't going to give you insights into what the MAGA base thinks. But she could. And so I do think she would be, I mean, who knows? But she has options. And I think a lot of news organizations would be interested in having someone like that on the show.
She's compelling. And she certainly has gained. You mentioned that a lot of people don't know who their own representative is, but people know who Marjorie Taylor Greene is. And I think that is certainly something that media organizations are looking for. Okay, Jan says, doesn't anyone on the panel think that Marjorie Taylor Greene is looking at running against Ossoff and Warnock in the Senate? That seems likely to me.
It's possible, too.
You know, Terry, the other thing I was thinking about, you touched on you know, her, what she has done, and she was a huge fundraiser for the Republican Party and for MAGA. And I wonder what that will do now, of where that money will go and what will happen, because she, much like the, well, I say much like, similar to the AOC Bernie Sanders roadshow, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz used to go around and make tons of money for MAGA. And I wonder, Terry, if you know, where that goes now.
Yeah, I don't know. It's one of the reasons why I think it is a loss for the Republican Party. One of the many reasons is that they're losing a person that has really been able to help keep them afloat in all kinds of different controversies. And they just don't really have someone that has that kind of personality, TV personality, radio personality, just that face, the voice. They don't really have a replacement for certainly not a woman replacement. It would have to be one of the men. And they're kind of like all the same. You know, kind of just vanilla, literally, and so I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see where she ends up. I do think that she can still put enormous pressure on the Trump administration from the outside if she lands in the right sort of media outlet.
Let's go to other letters. We go to Leslie. Do you really think she is? I just read that. My apologies. Steve says she's leaving just in time to qualify for a pension. Her call for decency in politics now is like Hugh Hefner taking a deathbed vow of celibacy. All right. Paints a picture, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does.
Let's see. Joseph says, good morning, team. MTG is leaving because, one, her life is now being threatened. Which, by the way, I think is a huge reason. I don't think people would talk about that enough. I mean, she's been mentioning it over the last several weeks. And, I don't think you can downplay that.
No, but the president just threatened the lives of, what, five or six Democratic elected officials who dare to speak up against
Well, no doubt. But I'm saying that people who are coming to your home and people who are making death threats to you, that it can be a game changer if you don't want to get
yes, but the deafening killed. Silence of the fire at Josh Shapiro's house, right? And that was right at Passover. You know, the deafening silence of a lot of from the Republicans about a lot of the violence perpetrated on Democratic elected officials is, you know, I don't want anybody to hurt her. That's not what being in politics should be. Political violence has no place, especially in a democracy, if we can still maintain it. But, you know, did she say anything about Josh Shapiro? No.
We go to
more.
That was number
more.
One.
Right.
Life being threatened. Two, her congressional future is quite limited. Three, she hits 5 years of service and a lifetime pension 2 days before resignation. No mystery here.
And health care.
XOXO Joe is what it says, and I like that. So I guess I'm curious as to where we go from here in the sense of I guess we'll see what she has to say after she leaves office and after there is a sort of a calming of the waters over the holiday break. And then it'll be 1 year of this administration and the beginning of the ramp up to the midterms, and we'll see.
Thank God.
And then all hell breaks loose, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's been some there with 435 members of House, there's always some coming and going or you know, vacancies, but like she's putting her party, They only have 219 Republicans in there now. And with her departure in early January, you'll be down to 218. So, I mean, Congress hasn't been doing a lot. It's been very, you know, it seems to have been okay just sort of letting President Trump do what he wants and sitting on the sidelines. But there's something it has to do. Like, it has to. The continuing resolution, the budget resolution that was just passed, will expire at the end of January. Mm-hmm. So, like, Mike Johnson has to get that done. He'll have an even narrower margin to do so. So it's, I mean, it is unusual. Like Terry was saying, it's like lots of people have, you know, announced that they are not going to seek another term, but they're going to go through the end of their term. They're going to go through the end of the 119th Congress. So her decision to do, you know, to leave mid-cycle, it is an odd and unusual choice.
It's a little mind-boggling.
And I mean, they won't be able to have a special election, I don't think, until like March. So it will it will sit empty for a while.
Do you think the term political industrial complex is going to stick?
You're looking at me because I represent that here.
When I heard her say that, it reminded me of things quite a few of my students say. Like, I think I mentioned we did this massive voter registration drive we have for 3 years now. And I'll tell you, the students don't. I mean, there's always concerns. Are they all the students going to, you know, register Democrat and change the outcomes of the election? They register independent. They don't want anything to do with either of the parties. And some of the things she said criticizing both of the parties, I feel like are very similar to things, you know, I have my students do these political autobiography presentations, and one just got up and he was like, I don't like either of the parties. I don't want to vote for either of them. I feel like I'm consenting to what they're going to do, and I don't support any of it. So
that's 80% of my students.
Yeah.
I think the majority of, I don't know what generation it is, but a majority of younger folks don't want to be identified. Yeah. There's people in the LGBT community. They don't want to be identified. You know, they don't want to be labeled. I'm like, if you don't say who you are, then we can't get the bills passed, right? We can't get the laws changed. But there's a lot of that going around. And you know, part of it is we don't teach civics, you know, and we don't teach what it means to be part of our democracy and all of that. And part of it is just that they don't want to be part of that and what their parents might have been a part of.
But I don't want to be identified with a political party. So I've grown up in Germany, as my accent probably gives away. There are several viable political parties. And I have never in my life ever referred to myself as a Green Partier. Or even a social democrat, right? It's like I still vote in Germany. I vote with the party that represents the policies that I think are the right policies at the time. And of course, the entire political system is very different, but it is very much at the heart of the problem that we're dealing with is this two-party system, and asking people to align with one or the other. And once they're aligned, the thinking process comes from the top down. They tell us what to think, and people just take it in. So I'm with my students on that. I understand why they don't want to be aligned, but then of course we have this odd primary election system, which again is truly unique in the United States. So it's a complex issue, and I think but also gets to the heart of many of the problems we're facing as a society.
Terry, what have you found with your students and how they identify?
Yeah, I think that's about right. There is definitely a lean towards being an independent and not feeling incredibly loyal to either party. And that trend, I think, has come out of the way that they have sort of been exposed to political news in their short lives, and it all really coming from sources like TikTok that have allowed a wide variety of social media influencers to really control the narrative about how politics works, and they're listening more and more to those influencers than they are the leaders of any particular party. The leaders of any particular party have less and less of a voice and less influence, I think, across that generation and generations to come, because they're not gaining the type of followers that these others gain on a platform like TikTok. And they're just not as interesting, and they're not as relatable. And much of what's wrong with our political system today and with the messages coming from our political leaders is that they're not speaking in terms that are relevant. They're not using examples that are relevant. They're not relating to the real day-to-day issues that this generation is facing, especially as it relates to housing, cost of college, cost of living, job creation, all of that. They're just not addressing it and speaking to it in terms that they can appreciate.
If we use old school terms like right and left, do the students, though, tend to be more to the left or no?
I don't think so. I mean,
all over the place.
Yeah, no. I mean, at the end of George W. Bush's administration and then Obama, like, there was definitely a sort of, I was like, oh, look at this. The young people are liberal and they love Obama. And that has all changed. That has all changed. So I do not think that they are overwhelmingly liberal on my college campus. It's very diverse. And I mean, a lot of them were, you know, deeply affected by Charlie Kirk's murder and are, I think, play a big role in that sort of whole manosphere kind of thing, getting their news from, you know, Joe Rogan and all the younger versions of him. And that's really their, and you can see that there's like a traditionalism in a lot of their values and stuff like that. So it's very different than it was a decade ago. Yeah.
And, you know, and we have to look at, I mean, it's not just the younger generation. You look at the voter rolls. It's 30 Republican, 30 Democrat, and 40 NOP, or not no party. But when we look at the results of the election of this year, which was local elections here in New York, right, we saw the beginning of the blue wave, where people who do not have a party or are not in a party are saying, I didn't sign up for this. I didn't sign up for these ICE raids. I didn't sign up for the Epstein files. I didn't sign up for any of this. And that's not the Democratic Party. That's the Republican Party. And so we saw that. I mean, we saw the Onondaga County Legislature flip to Democratic control. We saw very thin margins where Democrats won in town councils. You know, it's really very interesting to watch. And once the re-canvas comes out and we can really look into the numbers, we'll be able to see where those patterns are. But it had to have happened where people, the folks that are not in a party voted for the Democratic candidate because they don't like what's going on. And that's not what they signed up for.
So, Libby, I'm wondering, do you think, and I'm wondering about surfed the dynamics over the last couple of years, are we maybe moving away from this strict party affiliations that made it almost impossible, really, to shift election outcomes based on policy debates? Are we moving away from that as if we see a larger percentage of not just young people, but across the board, where people just say, I'm not going to vote with a political party because I'm affiliated with that. I'm going to vote against the political party that does things that I don't agree with. Are we possibly moving toward policy-driven election dynamics?
Well, I think, from my perspective, elections are always policy-driven.
Yeah.
Okay, I vote for pro-choice, pro-LGBT candidates, and those are the people I work for. Right. I think that the money behind politics is invested in the two-party system, Democrats and Republicans. I think that a third party in this country, unless it's MAGA, and he decides, Trump, he's going to start a third party and bankroll it, which we all know that's, you know, not what he does, then it's possible to see it. But the last time we saw a strong third party presidential candidate was Ross Perot. I mean, you know, and so I don't see it really happening. It's going to be a generational thing, and not next generation, but generations a little further down, because there are younger folks who are identifying with parties. There are active young Democrat groups all over the state. There's the young Republican group, and we all saw how lovely they are with their anti-Semitic and racist comments on social media. So, you know, I don't think we're moving away from this two-party system here. I just think that both parties need to recognize that there's a larger swath that don't want to be identified with either, and you have to court those votes. You
right.
have to message to those people so that they feel that the party is talking to them.
We have to take a break. We will do just that and return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our panel discussion has the following individuals making up its panel today. Laurel Elder is here, Terry Gibson, Libby Post, Karen Riedel, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I was going to move on to a new subject, and I will certainly, but during the break we got quite a few letters about our last subject, about voting and party affiliation and all of that. So I would just like to address some of these letters. Rich says, I'm a Republican voter who is disappointed with what's happening in Washington. I would willingly vote for a moderate Democrat for president in the next election. And many of my Republican friends feel the same way. Mm-hmm. If the Democrats want to win the White House, they won't do it by putting up a far left leaning Democratic candidate, but with a moderate Democratic candidate, all the Democrats will vote for them, and many of us Republican moderates would as well. Am I missing something here?
Well, I think you'll see a push from the left of the party for that person to embrace some of the more left-of-center ideals. But ultimately, I do think they'll vote for the Democratic nominee because they want to get rid of Trump or whoever's coming after him. It won't be pretty, that's for sure. The Democrats don't fall in line that quickly.
Yeah, I would just say this debate, I'm chuckling a little bit because I know this same debate about should Democrats be running moderates or should they be running more progressive or liberal candidates. It's like we were discussing this a lot when I was in graduate school, which was like 3 decades ago. You would think that the moderate candidate would be the way to go in a two-party system. If you just sort of look at where voters are distributed, capturing the center, mm-hmm. seems like it would be the place where you can maximize your votes. But it's also about voter turnout. We've had high voter turnout for the United States over the past three election cycles or more, but still only like 60%. So, which is not high compared to most other, Democratic nations. And so it's really about turnout, too. So I just don't know how inspiring another like moderate candidate would be for Democrats, a progressive candidate, a Mamdani type candidate. Could inspire a lot more people to vote. So I don't know that it's that easy. Like just put up a moderate and that's the best way. It depends on how charismatic the person is.
Well, we're making it sound like it's a strategic decision, but it's not because it comes down to primary elections. And again, I mentioned it earlier, this is a truly unique system that we've had since the progressive era. There is no other country that allows the broad masses who are not involved in politics on a day-to-day basis to choose not just the candidate, but by choosing candidates, we're choosing which way the political parties are going. If we're choosing, if the primary voters choose a centrist, then that's the way the party's going to go. If the primary voters choose a more left-winger or extreme right-wing representative on the Republican side, then that's where these parties are going. That's what happened in 2016 when the voters elected Trump to be the head of the Republican Party. That is how the party went. So it's not a strategic decision. It's a decision of the very, very few voters who actually come out for primary elections. I once looked at, I don't nail me in the actual numbers anymore, but I looked at what the percentage of eligible voters who actually voted for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in 2016 to the primary election, it came down to some 5% of eligible voters who chose not just the candidates, but the way the political parties would run.
Terry Gibson.
I just don't think our current political landscape is favorable to anybody trying to run as a moderate. I think it's really hard to gain traction, to raise money, to really build a coalition. I think it's just much easier for somebody that is, I wouldn't go as far as say extreme, but less moderate, I think is a more viable candidate in this political environment, because there are just so many issues that have been left unchecked for decades that are just literally out of control and need to be managed in a relatively extreme, radical way to correct them. For instance, just take the housing crisis as one example. I mean, that's there's not really a moderate way to go about reforming that system. There needs to be a radical change. So I think somebody that just kind of has a middle ground, let's all just get along message, I think it's going to have a problematic campaign in terms of raising money, building a coalition.
Three quick letters. Jared says, I'm 42 and I feel disenfranchised by politics. Social media isn't the reason youth are becoming disenchanted. Grassroots activists and grassroots politics get a platform on social media and they are plainly displaying the hypocrisy of both parties. The Democrats voting against socialism when a popular candidate wins a platform running as a democratic socialist is an example. DHS Twitter account has been based out of Israel, living in a rich nation that lets people go hungry and homeless. How can you not be disappointed in the system? Your German guest is right. The problem is a two-party system and people aligning behind politics and not principles and morality. We go to Maureen. I am a late baby boomer who also registers in a party so I can vote in primaries in New York State. I change at least once a decade to other options. When will New York State let people who don't really want the extreme of either party have a voice in the primaries? Ever, Libby?
If you want to vote in the Democratic primary, enroll as a Democrat. If you want to vote in the Republican primary, enroll as a Republican. It's just that simple. As
but
far
if you
as
want
I'm
to be
concerned,
a Democrat and you want to vote for the Republican.
You can't do that in a primary. You can do it in the general election.
Okay.
Nobody knows how you vote, ostensibly, right? And I think in terms of who the next presidential pairing will be for the Democratic Party, you'll have the president be somebody like Andy Beshear, and you'll have the vice president be somebody a little further left.
So there'll never be an open primary in New York, in your opinion?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, unfortunately, the way the election laws are set up, it is sort of an incumbent protection plan. But if you get to be the incumbent, you know, you get to run again. And if you don't do anything really bad, you'll get reelected.
Casey is 28 years old and says young people today feel little loyalty or obligation to the two-party system. And honestly, who can blame us? It has failed us. It has failed us in too many ways. Yes, civics education is incredibly important, but a true civics lesson also teaches that our system was never meant to be confined to just two parties. In fact, George Washington warned in his farewell address that rigid party structures could become dangerous to the Republic. That from Casey. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us move on to other issues and another big topic making news this morning is as the U.S. presses for peace, Zelensky says Ukraine faces a critical moment. There were many talks yesterday and a lot of back and forth. And the president of the United States is saying that great progress is being made. I believe actually the quote is something good just may be happening. So that was the quote. President Zelensky of Ukraine said on Monday that his country was at a critical moment after talks with American officials over a U.S.-backed proposal aimed at ending the war with Russia. President Trump said in a social media post that something good just may be happening in the talks, but gave no details. Mr. Trump has set a deadline of Thursday, Thanksgiving, for Ukraine to agree to the plan, an early draft of which many Ukrainians deemed overly favorable to Moscow. Mr. Trump said on Sunday that Ukraine's government had been insufficiently thankful for American aid and other support since Russia's 2022 invasion. Mr. Zelensky later said his country was grateful for everything that America and President Trump are doing for Secretary. I've said it once. I'll say it again. You have to get out your thank you notes in a reasonable time frame. So, where does this leave us? The president is calling Ukraine ungrateful. And Marco Rubio is saying that he is hopeful, and he has reemerged from talks with Ukrainian officials, telling reporters in Geneva that tremendous progress was made and that he was very optimistic. Terry Gibson.
Well, I just wouldn't believe anything you're hearing out of Marco Rubio's mouth or Donald Trump's mouth, or really anybody in the presidential administration at this point in time. It's depending on which media source you read on this story, and I read five or six this morning, the messaging is all over the place. The one thing that's clear is that it seems to me to be impossible for Ukraine to sign what appears to be a current deal that basically gives Russia everything they want, including the part of Ukraine that they've taken over. I just can't see that is going to be allowed, because if they sign on to that, what it basically says is that anybody who wants to go invade a country and take over part of another country will eventually be allowed to get away with it. It doesn't make any sense. So I think that also what's happening is that there's a real confusion behind the scenes with the Trump administration between negotiating for peace and negotiating for profits. I think there's a lot of movement behind the scenes by people that are aligned with the Trump administration trying to find ways to make money on this deal. And I think that's having a big sway in how the discussions are going, and that seems to be clear by some of the leaked messages. The leaders in Ukraine are doing a good job of trying to manage the media. It appears that they intentionally leaked some of the initial offerings to kind of show how ridiculous they were. And then, of course, they've come back in public and tried to apologize, tried to play nice. I think they're in a tough spot, and I don't think that our country, our leadership right now, is proven to really be capable and responsible of doing this in a way that's going to really benefit democracy and freedom moving forward.
Karen.
To just elaborate on what he already just explained, in this wish list, as Marco Rubio himself said, this is a Russian wish list, and then he pedaled back from it. But that's clearly what it is. It doesn't just require Ukraine to give up the territory they have lost as a result of the aggressive, violent invasion of Russia and Ukraine, but it would require Ukraine to also give up areas that they're still fighting for. It would require them to sign onto a treaty that would not allow them to join any intergovernmental organizations that would protect them. And it would require them to reduce the military force. It would leave Ukraine weaker, more vulnerable than it is today. It does not include any real security assurances that would be akin to Article 5 in the NATO Charter that would ensure that if they are attacked again, which under this treaty would be almost inevitable, that they would actually be protected by an international force. I am glad, let me just, however, say I'm glad that we're back at the negotiation table and that Ukraine is actually at the table, because for a while it looked actually quite realistic that the United States would pull out of this negotiations that would keep would protect Ukraine, keep Europe safer, but also keep our interest alive in this region, our own security. It looked for a while like this may actually be a possibility. I'm glad we're back. I'm also glad that I hear that the Europeans will be invited back to the table. And they may have been involved this morning. It does look, but the last thing I've heard is that they're working, that they're using this as a template, that Russian wish list, and they're reworking it, and they're hopeful. That's what I take from the discussions this morning, that they're hopeful that Ukraine will, that the wish list will look in a way that Ukraine can sign on to, but Russia will then never sign on to this modified piece of paper, right? I'm glad we're back at the negotiation table. I think the right parties are there now, excluding Russia. Russia needs to be part of those negotiations, of course, but I don't see this is going to lead to a resolution and the end of the war.
Laurel.
I was just thinking, I think Trump, for quite a few reasons, really wants a deal. He wants to strike a peace deal. I think, as everyone said, like, I don't think his interest is in necessarily getting one that's good for Ukraine, but I a couple things. I teach a class on Congress and the presidency. And so and we talk about the two presidency theory. This political scientist, Aaron Wildofsky, came up with it. And it's just the idea that presidents have a lot more success in terms of foreign policy than domestic policy. They have more actual powers in foreign policy. Congress is usually more deferential, and the public doesn't pay a lot of attention to foreign policy. So they have a lot more room to maneuver. And I think a lot of people have been surprised at how much President Trump has focused on international issues and foreign policy in his second presidency. And I think it's because, I mean, he is having more success and he has more room to maneuver. Domestically, people are so concerned with affordability. That issue is just off the charts in terms of people's priorities. And he's getting very low marks on it. Even a third of Republicans are saying they're not satisfied with the job Trump is doing in terms of cost of living, affordability. And the reality is presidents don't have a lot of power over the domestic economy, and so there's not that much he can do. So anyway, pivoting to international events, even though they're super challenging, in many ways makes sense. It's also, in terms of public opinion, I was looking at some polling in Ukraine, that the people are so tired, they're so fatigued. Close to 70% now say they want a negotiated end to the war. They do not want to fight until victory anymore. And Americans are like sort of all over the place on this issue, but most prominently, they just don't care about it that much. So, you know, it's like Trump has sort of an opening here to come in and say, I'm the one who can deliver peace. And he sees himself as a uniquely skilled negotiator, and he really wants to win a Nobel Prize. So all these factors really sort of lean into why, you know, I think he's pushing for this. But like I said, he wants a deal. I do not think he has incentives to push for a deal that's really in the best interest of democracy and Ukraine.
Libby Post.
Well, I think he was buddy-buddy with Mamdani in the Oval Office. I mean, Mamdani never sat down. And that was a power thing for Trump. I can sit, you have to stand next to me, blah, 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 blah. But he was nice to him, right? You know, when they asked the fascist question, he was like, yeah, it's okay. I know, right?
That was actually stunning.
It was stunning.
Yes.
But he has to show that he can still be the strong man. And he's doing it with Ukraine. He's done it with Ukraine the entire time that he's been in the presidency. That shameful display last February in the Oval Office with Zelensky. You know, if Trump could, he would just take what Putin wants and force it down Ukraine's throat, and that would be the end of it. And he'll spin it as a peace plan. Europe doesn't want this, and what Trump is also doing is putting our relationships with the European Union at risk. You know, I think he wants to be able to build a hotel on the Russian Riviera, whatever that is over there. But nonetheless, he's putting our relationships, our solid relationships since World War II, on the chopping block because he wants to ameliorate Putin. And, you know, I know that he's put sanctions on, and I know all of that's happening. But ultimately, he wants to be Putin. He wants to be able to say, this is what we're doing, and that's the end of the conversation, because that's what happens in Russia. So, you know, I get the Ukrainian people being tired, you know, and it seems like this ongoing, never-ending thing that's happening to them, that they're constantly, you know, under siege. What I saw the other night was one of the demands is Russia returning 20,000 children that they kidnapped. And Russia is denying that they kidnapped any children. And so that will all end up probably being a sticking point. But for the American electorate, no president gets elected on a foreign policy issue. They get unelected on a foreign policy issue. That's why LBJ didn't run in '68, right? It was the Vietnam War, you know? So they get they either take themselves out of the running or they lose because of foreign policy. But none of them ever run on it because people want affordability. They want health care. They want to know what's going on in their own backyard and what's going to happen to their children.
Does anybody have a 23-second thought?
Why? That's what we have
yeah,
left here?
Yeah, that's exactly it. If not, I can fill otherwise.
Why don't you fill?
Is
there a letter?
I have a 23-second
okay,
thought.
Okay, great.
You're so right. No president will ever be elected on a foreign policy issue, but that is precisely because our leaders and practitioners in the field have failed to convey to the American public the significance of our foreign policy to our own interests and our own security and our economic well-being.
The last one who did it was FDR, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
We have another half hour of conversation. We have many more topics to discuss, and we will do just that. We always welcome you to get in on the fun. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We just ask that you keep your letters short and to the point, that you don't include links or attachments. That's really helpful because when there's links, well, first of all, we don't open them, but we really can't open them while we're actively doing the show, so that and it gets messy.
Yeah, just don't send them.
Yep. So short and to the point, verbs are great. We'll be back right after this. Not that I'm counting, but we're at the halfway point of the show this morning. And
No, we're not.
Yeah. Oh, for the total show.
Oh, for the total show.
Yeah, for
okay,
the whole
fine.
Show. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I
no, not
you.
This. No, not you. Yeah. I'm not keeping you till 12. Don't worry.
Yeah.
I know you're worried. Don't worry.
I got to go to work.
I know. I understand. And I thank you for staying as long as you're staying. All right. Let me my point of all that is we have time to get to some good topics here. I want to talk about Cash Patel because I want to talk about Cash Patel. When Alexis Wilkins, an aspiring country singer, dating the FBI director Cash Patel, sang the Star Spangled Banner at the National Rifle Association's annual convention in Atlanta. Can you believe such a thing? She arrived with a formidable protective posse, a SWAT team from the Bureau's local field office. They were... The two agents, members of a specialized unit trained to storm barricaded buildings and rescue hostages, had been sent there on Mr. Patel's orders. But seeing that the event at the Georgia World Congress Center had been secured and that Ms. Wilkins was in no apparent danger, they left before the event was over, according to six people who had knowledge of the incident. She noticed. So did her boyfriend. So soon after, Mr. Patel ripped into the team's commander, saying that his girlfriend had been left without taxpayer-funded defenders, and slamming what he saw as failure to communicate their movements up the chain of command during her time on the convention floor, where she sang and chatted with attendees, according to those there. He was concerned that Ms. Wilkins, a high-profile conservative, might be attacked by people who had threatened her online. Mr. Patel's heavy use of taxpayer-funded resources during his first 9 months on the job has contributed to growing questions inside the administration about whether it exceeds the bounds of standard practice. This includes an intense use of security to protect himself and his girlfriend. He has also used a government jet for some of his recreational travels, such as a golf trip with buddies to a private resort in Scotland over the summer. Directors, imagine making travel arrangements and that include bringing a SWAT team. Directors must fly on government aircraft for their travel because of required access to secure communications equipment. But using government jets for business trips or to return home if they have left settled lives in other parts of the country to serve in Washington requires planning and coordination. That article from the New York Times, that sarcastic tone from yours truly. All right. Who would like to begin?
Well, I mean, if a Democrat appointee had done this, all hell would be breaking loose on Fox News, right? We know that that's what would happen. They would go nutso, for the lack of not being able to say the word I want to say.
I remember a haircut on a tarmac.
Right. Well, there was that. Okay. A haircut on a tarmac. That's it. Not a SWAT team. And they're not married, you know? So here's the party of family values, right? Men and women should get married, have children, blah, blah, blah. Women should be subjugated. And these people are not married, right? And we're wasting taxpayer dollars on this person. I mean, give me a break.
Regardless if they were married, would we?
No.
I mean, would we be arguing to saying that he should do it if they were
married? No, if they were married, then there's coverage because it's part of the policy.
Yeah.
But they're not married, and there's still coverage. But, I mean, I'm sorry, bringing even two people from a SWAT team in to protect a country singer, a right-wing country singer, at some nominal event, you know, I want my money back. I want my money back.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I think it's important to remember that Donald Trump and Cash Patel have all either threatened to or have taken away or insisted that various members of the Democratic Party, elected officials in the Democratic Party, lose their protection, that they not have any protection. Mm. So there are many members of Congress that are under legitimate threats, who have legitimate elected positions, who have families, who are not being protected as they were under previous administrations. And so this just sort of adds to the hypocrisy of the Trump administration's way of seeing how government power should be used.
Laurel.
I mean, I was a little bit sympathetic to the fact that, you know, both Cash Patel and his girlfriend, who he did describe as his life partner, so I feel like, you know, I take that seriously, whether they're married or not. They have faced credible threats, and it sort of speaks to the very nasty tenor of our politics, which is a big concern for me. We talked about this with Marjorie Taylor Greene as well, and her citing that the fact that she'd received really, you know, terrible threats once Donald Trump called her a traitor. And I mean, that's just one issue. It's just like this makes it very unattractive for highly qualified people to want to go into public service and government. And that is a concern of mine and something I'm trying to work, you know, sort of against by, in, you know, through my Institute of Public Service, trying to get young people to consider careers in public service. But I also, I mean, it does sound like there's a leadership problem there, that they've had to rely on these SWAT teams because he hasn't organized the security ahead of time. And so that does sort of speak to a sort of chaotic leadership style. But I mean, I continue to think that in terms of public interest, the most important story about the FBI under Cash Patel is just the politicization of their work. I was reading a story, I think from Axios, that was talking about, I think just a couple weeks ago, that the FBI Agents Association, which like represents nearly all the active agents, issued a scathing rebuke against Patel, and because he's firing people, agents who are simply doing their jobs on politically sensitive investigations. And so, you know, if you worked on the January 6th case, you know, you're have been fired or in danger of being fired. And I just think that is so concerning for us as a society. FBI is doing important work. And the whole point of our bureaucracy is that these people are supposed to, you know, serve because they are qualified, and their work really shouldn't be changing dramatically depending on the party of the presidency. And so I do think what's going on in the FBI in terms of how it's becoming a tool of retribution is concerning.
Sure.
I agree with everything you just said. It's starting with the fact that I was if anything about this debate on the left about Patel's actions upset me, it was the focus on whether he was married or not. I don't think that should make a difference. But the focus, as you said, should really be on the shortcomings and the politicization of an agency that should not be politicized. So I fully agree with that. I just want to remind us all that Patel came into his position promising to decimate the FBI, mm-hmm. which in light of the funds that he's spending on travel to a show, to a concert, it's a little ludicrous.
I just have to say, as someone who couldn't get married,
yeah,
okay, right, for a really, really long time, this notion of, oh, well, it's okay that he's not married and we're going to spend taxpayer dollars because it's his life partner. I'm sorry, but I find that insulting to the LGBT community and myopic in the sense that all this Republican Party does is say women need to be subjugated, women need to serve their husbands, women, and that there needs to be marriage. They wanted to like change the welfare payments and, you know, give women money to get pregnant and have more kids. So, you know, I know it might seem like a little thing, but for those of us who were denied that right for so long, and let me just say, when we're denied that right, that means no hospital visitations, okay? That means family swoops in in the last minute to make healthcare decisions. That means family swoops in and takes the money, you know? Marriage is about love. There's no two ways about it. But for LGBT people, it's about hospital visits and money. And we can't deny that. And we can't say, oh, but it's okay for us to spend our tax dollars on protecting Kash Patel's girlfriend. I'm sorry.
I agree with all of you, but I think it's the wrong issue to be debating, I guess, because married or not, in this particular case, they're together, and I do agree. I think if they're together and that's his life partner, whether they're married or not. Okay, but is it the taxpayer's responsibility? And what is the taxpayer's responsibility? And do you need a SWAT team? That seems to be the issue.
It's about
the SWAT team.
Right, and the use of government services wrongly.
Yes.
Okay, that's what this whole story is about.
I think that whether it's his kid, whether it's his significant other, whether it's his wife of 30 years, whether it's himself of worrying about of having to come down to the point where you start bringing, like, who do you bring? Do you bring SWAT teams in for other people?
Well, that's the thing. It's like if Kash Patel wanted to make that kind of protection available for the five Democrats who are being targeted by Trump, well, okay, I can. That would be a good use of taxpayer dollars. But they're not. This is all political. It's all coming down to who's a good Republican, who's MAGA, who is supporting their agenda. And that's it.
Terry, anything you'd like to add to this?
I just think it's all ridiculous.
Yes, there is that.
It's so predictable. You appoint people to leadership roles in law enforcement that have no law enforcement experience and have really no leadership experience, and you somehow expect that something else is going to happen. I mean, it's all just so predictable and sad, and it leaves our country vulnerable. Here we are talking about what used to be one of the most powerful law enforcement agencies mm-hmm. in the country, if not the world, that is really supposed to be established to protect us, to protect citizens, and what is actually happening there? How are they spending their time? Their leader is more concerned about protecting a supposed country western singer who has no real claim to fame that rather than protecting the country. It makes no sense.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show. Last 10 minutes or so, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Last call for letters. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And we are going to continue, wrap up as we get to the 11 o'clock point here in the hour and have a topic or two left in us. So we will do that this morning. Let's talk about Border Patrol. Let's talk about the city of Charlotte, North Carolina. And so where did Border Patrol spend its time over the weekend? In country clubs and upscale shops. That's what we are finding out from the Washington Post. As undocumented immigrants stayed home and federal agents swept through the city, even the wealthiest neighborhoods got a glimpse of what life without migrants might look like. The gourmet pasta shop surrounded by million-dollar colonials might not be the most obvious spot for clues about how hundreds of U.S. Border Patrol officers have swept across the city of Charlotte in recent days. Pasta and Provisions, the longtime local favorite in the Myers Park neighborhood, is more popular among well-to-do bankers who populate the city's soaring financial office buildings than the working-class immigrants who flocked here to help build that skyline. There is little Spanish spoken outside of the shop's kitchen. But as armed federal agents and unmarked SUVs poured into North Carolina's largest city, the store was not immune from the Trump administration's targeted immigration enforcement operation that launched on November 15th. "It's taking a toll everywhere," said the pasta store's owner, Tommy George, who took shifts washing dishes after one employee's husband had been detained in the sweep. "In a way, the consequences are in every neighborhood." Local officials said they were told the operation has ended, although the Department of Homeland Security, which said it had arrested about 370 people as of Friday, said that Operation Charlotte's Web...
I keep saying after the children's book. I'm like, it just seems wrong.
E.B. White is rolling in his grave.
He certainly is.
Yes.
And considering how Trump and his cronies, you know, butcher grammar, he's even rolling even more.
Yeah. And if they're going to use an E.B. White book, it should be in this case.
The Elements.
Trumpet of the Swan.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Because Elements...
Foregoing Stuart Little.
Right. The Elements of style just doesn't quite...
That's a good point.
They'll think it's about how you're dressing.
Yes. The effect on George's business is emblematic of how the Border Patrol operation has rippled across the lines of race and class and have long divided the city, spilling into Tony neighborhoods where many residents gave little thought to how President Donald Trump's deportation push would affect them. That from the Washington Post, Karen Riedel.
Yeah. The impact of this race is particularly tragic in regard to how it affects children. It's children, no matter what the legal status is, the children of minority background are staying home from school because the parents are worried that they'll be swept up in these raids. What an extraordinary thing to do. But on the other hand, here's the silver lining. Whenever the middle class is directly affected, that is when we see changes. That was the case back then in apartheid South Africa, where once our sanctions affected the middle class in South Africa, the white middle class, that is when pressure was put on the government to end the apartheid regime. And during the civil rights movement, the march in Birmingham was as effective as it was because it affected the white middle class. And so now this is one as this approach to immigration broadens and more people who felt that they were going to be not affected by it will actually be affected. That is when the pressure on the government to make changes will grow.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking about the kids as well. And I know chronic absenteeism is a huge problem across the schools. I know my daughter's in high school and they just sent out a thing like, please come to school today and tomorrow. Like, there's been so many people who've missed. And I see it as a college professor, too. Like, students don't come to class nearly as often as they used to. Anyway, and
the reason being,
it's post-COVID. I mean,
okay, post-COVID.
Yes. So
okay, I thought you were bringing the two stories together.
Yeah, it's just
worried that kids are going.
Yeah,
to
so
be...
now this is another reason for kids to not go to school. And I think even after the Border Patrol federal agents leave, I think kids won't immediately go back to school.
Yeah.
I think it's gonna worsen and already big problem. But I think the bigger issue is, and this really sort of builds on something Karen said as well, just whether this is shifting the public opinion dynamics on this issue. Now, President Trump is not popular right now. He's only got like 40% approval ratings. And on every single issue, he is, as they say, underwater. People disapprove more than they approve. Now, that said, he's still doing the best, believe it or not, on immigration, depending on how the question. Than all other issues. People actually, majority of Americans want border security. They want order in our immigration policy. Almost everybody supports the idea of deporting undocumented immigrants who have committed a crime. But there's a lot of nuance in this, and there's a lot of public opinion polling showing that, you know, depending on, like, people are not supportive of federal agents treating people inhumanely or going after children or long-term residents or detaining citizens or people who are here legally. And so there's all these things. So I almost wonder, there's a theory called the thermostatic theory of public opinion. The idea is just that when government policy goes too far in one direction, public opinion moves in the opposite direction. And I do think that, you know, the news stories coming out of Charlotte are such that it could be shifting public opinion in the opposite direction, moving it further away from the policies that Trump is trying to implement. And the other thing is just like all of this disruption in people's lives and fear and affecting the community. And in the end, you know, 370 people were arrested and only about like two dozen of those were actually criminals, had any kind of criminal record. So it's just like, was that worth it? The trauma that it sort of created for all these communities.
They don't care about the trauma. That's the thing. Trump and his ilk do not care about the trauma. They want this to be a white country. They want people who speak Spanish to be gone, anybody with dark skin to be gone. And, you know, it doesn't really matter to them. And cruelty is part of their... It's cruelty, corruption, and chaos. And cruelty is a big part of their ethos. And we're seeing it play out every time somebody, ICE comes knocking on somebody's door. They don't care about the rule of law. They don't have warrants. They just do whatever the hell they want because they have masks over their faces and a big ICE across their chest. So, you know, this is part and parcel of what Trump thinks will make America great again.
Terry Gibson, last word with you.
I feel like it's worth noting that there are a large segment of Trump supporters that are in the category that we would classify as wealthy or ultra wealthy. And they certainly employ undocumented workers to clean their mansions, to pick up their dry cleaning, to do their gardening. And they have just proceeded with business as usual, hoping that the whole effort to remove undocumented workers would not affect them. But when they begin to encroach into their Tony restaurants, into their wealthy enclaves, all of a sudden they start getting nervous. And I think that it just shows the discriminatory policy that the Trump administration is using. And it kind of fits in with America's history of allowing the wealthy to really be an exception to the rule and continuing to build wealth really on the backs of those who are disadvantaged, if not enslaved, or if not essentially, you know, being allowed to work here in poverty, which is what many of these immigrant communities are doing. They're doing real work for the American people, for the American public, for American business, and being paid almost nothing to do it and living in conditions that are really unacceptable to anyone else. So it just goes, again, to really underline the hypocrisy that is in any policy of the Trump administration. And it's interesting to see some media picking up on this.
We are out of time. I want to thank everyone for being with us this morning. And thank you, Terry Gibson. Always wonderful to have you on the program. Karen Riedel, Warren Elder. Laurel, you'll be back.
I'll be back in December.
Oh, that's good. Okay, we don't have to wait, though. Okay. Laurel Elder, thank you very much for being with us, as always. And Libby Post, thank you. We'll take a break, and we will continue with our third hour of the roundtable after this short break.